Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The situation in Syria is getting more complicated as the war is crossing borders into Lebanon and Iraq. The death toll continues to rise and the refugee crisis worsens. Earlier this month, the UN stopped updating Syria's death toll because the situation is so dire. According to the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a pro-opposition monitoring group, more than 1,000 people have died in just 2 weeks of fighting in Syria. And according to the London-based Channel 4 News, Palestinians at a refugee camp in Damascus are starving to death after 6 months under Syrian siege. So joining us to put all of this in perspective is Borzu Daragahi. He's Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, and he joins us from Cairo. Hi, Borzu. Welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure.
Nice to have you. And we're joined by Mark Seibel, Chief of Correspondence for McClatchy Newspapers, which publishes 30 daily papers, including the Sacramento Bee and the Fresno Bee. McClatchy has been working with a Syrian activist as a fixer. He had to leave northern Syria because of the Al-Qaeda presence, and he is now connecting McClatchy reporters with Syrian activists on the ground. McClatchy also has a reporter in Damascus. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Rose. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. And a little later in the show, we will talk about media coverage of President Obama's speech about the NSA spying program. He gave that this morning. And then we will also talk about coverage of the chemical spill in West Virginia, which left 300,000 people without clean water. But as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Mark, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I want to praise something that the Washington Post did. Greg Miller is the reporter. He covers national intelligence and the intelligence agencies. And he wrote a piece a day ago, or maybe 2 days ago now, that pointed out that Congress is preparing a secret law, an addendum to the appropriations bill, that would prevent the drone program from being transferred from the CIA to the Pentagon. And this is something that you know, nobody really wanted anyone to know. Your listeners might recall that at the beginning of the year, earlier in the year, last year, the president said that because of the problems with the drone program, lots of legal questions, whether the CIA has any protection under international law as it conducts the drone program, that it was going to move gradually from the CIA to the Pentagon. And now Congress has stepped in to make sure that doesn't happen, which will keep the drone program cloaked in secrecy, and it will prevent really a lot of reforms that people think ought to take place with that program.
And these are Democrats and Republicans who don't want this to happen?
Yes.
What is the main reasoning?
They'd like to maintain the secrecy of the program.
So what would happen if it was transferred from the CIA to the Pentagon? There would be more transparency?
There'd be more transparency. There'd also be a certain application of the laws of war in the use of drones. And, you know, one of the problems is you have in the CIA program, you have civilians, people not in uniform, conducting these missions, and they're not really protected by the laws of war.
Hmm.
You know, it's a conundrum. One of the things that the president said in his speech is he'd like to get the CIA back to doing analysis and not being war fighters. And that was the intention of moving the drone program eventually to the Pentagon.
Just quickly, Mark, do you have a reporter who specifically focuses on drones? Because Jeremy Scahill's Dirty Wars is getting a lot of attention now because it's up for an Oscar in the documentary section. And his film focuses on drones and just how difficult it is to report on what actually happens on the ground in other countries.
Well, Jonathan Landay, who covers national security for us, has written several pieces about the drone program, and in fact, last year did some pretty groundbreaking reporting on what internal CIA documents had to say about casualties and who the targets were of the drone program, which contradicted what Obama administration officials had been saying publicly about it. They knew with much less certainty who they were killing than the public statements would have suggested.
All right. So kudos to Greg Miller of The Washington Post, and we'll put a link to that story right after the show. Thank you for that. And what about you, Borzu? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I thought that there was a story that the New York Times had by David Kirkpatrick and Carlota Gall. It was sort of like a tale of two post-Arab Spring countries, Egypt and Tunisia. And I just thought it was a really smart way of covering, A, the constitutional referendum in Egypt this week, and B, the process of approving a constitution in Tunisia almost simultaneously that was happening. And it just sort of compared and contrasted what the commentator described as a train wreck in Egypt with the sort of attempt at tolerance and democratic compromise that's taking place now in Tunisia, and showed and compared and contrasted the differences between the two countries and the paths they've taken in a very smart way that was not a waste of copy. I think too much of our time is spent writing these sort of middling news stories that don't tell the readers a whole lot. And this was a smart, clever way of bringing context to these two different countries.
So what did they come up with? What are the main differences? Why are there so many differences in these documents?
Well, I think it's not even just a matter of the documents, it's a matter of the democratic processes in these two countries. But I think one of the main differences is that, you know, in Egypt, you have this very, very powerful army that has been an arbiter of much of what has happened there over the last 3 years since the Arab Spring, as they call it, began. Whereas in Tunisia, the most powerful institution in the country is actually a labor union, which has forced the Islamists and the secularists to make a compromise, whereas in Egypt you had an army that at first sided with the Islamists against the liberals and the leftists, and then when the Islamists were discredited, sided with the secularists and leftists against the Islamists and wound up on top. Whereas perhaps in Tunisia there was a little bit more of a civil society involvement in the process.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Egypt because, well, you're in Cairo, and we wanted to get an update about the plight of journalists working in Egypt. Three Al Jazeera journalists have been detained on the charge of working with a, quote, terrorist organization, meaning the Muslim Brotherhood. And an AP cameraman was arrested a couple of days ago outside of a polling station covering Egypt's constitutional referendum. And 40 correspondents representing 29 media organizations sent a letter to Egyptian authorities demanding the journalists' immediate release and calling for the release of other journalists who've been detained. So what is it currently like in Egypt, and how challenging is it for you to work in this environment?
Well, I think it is somewhat challenging. I think it's a little easier for us print correspondents versus those who have to lug a big TV camera around. We're able to be a little bit more discreet. But, you know, there is a lot of hostility towards the foreign press, towards international media. There's a feeling that Egypt is being attacked rhetorically all over the world by the international media. They turn on the television in other countries and they see the reports about what's happening in Egypt. And it goes very much against how they view what's happening in Egypt. And so there's a lot of friction there. You got to be a little bit cautious. You got to be a little bit careful about when you disclose you're a journalist and what you say about Egypt in public.
And Mark, Nancy Youssef is on the ground in Egypt. She writes for McClatchy. We've had her on several times. How concerned are you for her safety now that the situation has gotten so volatile in Egypt?
Well, we're always a little bit nervous when she's going out. You know, she's visited Mohamed Fahmy in prison, took him some clothes and other things, wrote about that. She was able to see him. But, of course, we're always very aware that the response to particularly foreigners is very hostile now, and it seems to be promoted by the government.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you'll go out into a situation, and Nancy is of Egyptian descent, and as long as they think she's an Egyptian, the people standing around tend to be polite and accepting of her presence. As soon as it becomes obvious to them that she is an American, then they turn on her.
Hmm. And that is Mark Seibel, chief of correspondence for McClatchy Newspapers, talking about what it's like for Nancy Youssef, a McClatchy correspondent, to report from Egypt. We're also joined by Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent with the Financial Times. He's joining us from Cairo, and he's reporting on the situation in Syria. And he'll be with us for a couple more minutes. So if you have any questions for him or any comments about media coverage of Syria, as the situation just seems to get worse, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Borzu, can you put this in perspective for us? Because you wrote a number of articles for the Financial Times this week. Syria opposition calls for more arms to fight al-Qaeda. The situation is getting more complicated because the war is crossing borders. The UN is not updating the death toll because the situation is so dire. And then there's supposed to be peace talks next week. So is it fair to say that the situation is getting worse on the ground?
I think that's fairly fair to say. I think that's pretty easy to say at this point. I mean, what you're seeing right now is a whole new dimension being added to the conflict in Syria. Whereas before it was the rebels against the regime, now you have this intra-fighting within the rebellion between the more hardline Islamists with a sort of transnational agenda and some of the other rebels, many of them Islamists, but with not as much of a hardline agenda as this one other group. And so you have a very complicated three-way battle developing. In addition, it appears that the regime of Bashar al-Assad has stepped up aerial bombardments of certain key civilian centers, especially Aleppo. And the fighting has gotten a lot fiercer in certain contested parts of the country, for example, east of Damascus, and in the south of the country near Deraa. There's been back and forth changes of control over certain territories. Whenever one of these changes takes place, whether it's between the rebels and the regime or between different rebel groups, what you see is like a tremendous amount of violence and killing. And that's why you're seeing this sort of deterioration of the situation.
And we've asked you this many times before when you're on the show, but you are reporting on Syria from Cairo. So can you talk about the difficulties involved in that and just what you're hearing from your contacts on the ground in Syria and how that's changed over the past few months?
Yeah, I mean, it's really impossible right now to vote unless you go to Damascus and then you're sort of under the tutelage of the regime, if you can get a visa. It's really impossible to go into rebel-held parts of Syria. I know some people are doing it. It's a very, very risky thing to do at this point because of the presence of this very hardline Islamist group. So in a way, you don't have a lot of choice. I have been to rebel-held parts of Syria, but at this point, my newspaper won't allow me, and most of my colleagues urge against it. But what they say, what people that we speak to on the ground say, is that the fighting is intense, it's fierce, and that civilians are often caught in the crossfire. You mentioned earlier in the show this tragedy unfolding at the Palestinian refugee camp just outside of Damascus called Yarmouk, where there has been, a lot of fighting between rebels and the regime, and really like starvation levels of depravity inside the camp, as both the regime and, according to some, the rebels complicate efforts to bring relief supplies into this camp.
When you're talking about civilians and all of these different factions, what choice do the civilians have besides to flee? And at this point, where can they go?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. You're talking about right now at least 8 million people out of 22 or 23 million or so Syrians displaced. That's a horrific number. More than one-third of the people have been displaced, either inside Syria or to other countries, mostly Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey, but also Egypt and European countries. They fled the conflict. Or they're, you know, moving from, and this is something I saw when I was in northern Aleppo, they're moving from town to town as the fighting comes to their town. They don't have enough money, really, to get out of the country, so they're just, you know, sleeping outdoors, sleeping in, on the floors of mosques, wherever they can, abandoned buildings, trying to scrape some food out of the harsh, terrorized landscape. Mm. You know, it's a real, real disaster unfolding in Syria. Unbelievable levels of suffering are taking place there.
And Mark, I understand that your correspondent, or McClatchy, was working with a Syrian activist who had to leave northern Syria because of the Al-Qaeda presence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, we'd been working for, I guess, a couple of years now with a guy named Musab Al-Hamadi, who was based in Idlib province, and he worked as a fixer for our correspondents who went into northern Syria, and we built up a good relationship with him. He actually came to the United States early last year for 3 months on a sabbatical, did some training here, and when he returned, or when he was about to return, he said everybody in northern Syria said, "Don't come back. It's not worth it." But he thought, you know, I've been an activist in the anti-Assad revolution. You know, I've been trained to do some things in terms of communications. I want to go back and participate. And he said as soon as he got back, he realized that he was not going to be allowed to do that. He did an interview with a top local official for the Nusra Front. And the Nusra Front is an Al-Qaeda affiliate that has been active since early 2012 in the rebel movement, responsible for many of the notable rebel military advances. But he wanted to do an interview with the guy so that people in Syria would be less concerned about Nusra's Al-Qaeda connection and see Nusra as a valuable part of the revolution, and to separate it from the other Al-Qaeda group that was operating at the time, which was the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, which we call shorthand ISIS, which had a much more radical vision in terms of imposing its will on the local population. Anyway, he does the interview. As he recounts it in a piece he did for us, he thought the interview came off well. The Nusra guy says, you know, we're not really part of ISIS. We don't necessarily agree with what ISIS is doing. And he was visited in the middle of the night, that as soon as that article was posted on a local Syrian Arabic language website, visited by armed men who were bringing the Nusra guy that he had interviewed with them, and they wanted Musab to confirm what he had said because their intention was to behead him. And the reason was that they, the Nusra people, were very unhappy that he had talked about there being a separation with ISIS. And viewed that statement as a rejection of Islam, and therefore death was the result. Musab put it off as best he could, and that sort of thing. The next day, they came back again with bringing the subject of his interview with him, and they presented him with a newspaper with a contract, basically an agreement, in which they told him, if you'll just say you really made this all up and you didn't interview this guy, then it'll just go away. And so Musab signed it. A few weeks go by. At this point, Musab is under the protection of the Free Syrian Army. An ISIS official comes to see Musab at his office, and he says, I have to tell you, you know, you're doing TV interviews, you're writing things, you cannot say anything bad about ISIS, you know, or you will pay a very heavy price. And as Musab wrote, he says, you know, he sort of assessed his situation. The FSA was getting supplanted by ISIS people all around him. They were taking cities and towns and villages and becoming a real influence. And he just realized, there is no way I can function in the way I want to function in northern Syria. It is clear that an Islamist doctrine is taking a firm grip here, even beyond ISIS, that women are being forced to veil, those kinds of things. And he said, my wife and I talked about it, and we decided we didn't want our daughter growing up in that kind of situation, and they left for Turkey, which is where he is now.
Borzu, I know we have to let you go, but, you know, it's really hard to make sense of what's going on because there are so many different factions and players. I mean, we didn't even talk about Saudi Arabia, the United States, Russia. What do you think is the end game here? Iran? Borzu?
End game is... I think there's a number of possibilities. One, very, very likely possibility is that this war will just drag on and on and on for a number of years, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, maybe 15 years. That's not out of the realm of possibility because of the interest of very powerful regional players such as Saudi Arabia and Iran in not letting the other side win. I think that's one very real possibility. And then the other, you know, very, very, maybe as horrible a possibility is that, you know, Bashar Assad's regime collapses at some point. And the infighting that you see now between the various rebel groups becomes the defining conflict of Syria. And so you have a sort of Afghanistan situation where after the fall of the Najibullah regime in 1990, in the early 90s, you had all these various Mujahideen groups fighting each other for control of the country, and the country even fell into a deeper mess. And I think that's also a very real possibility. What I see as less of a possibility is from this mess, Syria emerging as a relatively stable liberal democracy. Mm. I just don't see things heading that way, sadly, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, Borzu, thank you so much for staying up to join us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. That is Borzu Dargahi. He's Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He reports from Cairo because it's incredibly difficult to report from inside Syria. And Mark, we have about a minute before we go to break. What would you add to that in terms of the end game in Syria?
Well, it's difficult to see what the end game is. I mean, we're about to have the Geneva conference next week. It's on Wednesday is the starting point. We'll learn maybe tomorrow whether the Syrian opposition that we work with, the Syrian Opposition Coalition, and by we I mean the United States, we'll see whether they're going to actually send a representative. The problem is the armed groups that are active, and that would include the Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, which are ISIS and Nusra, and then the Islamic Front, which also has some major elements that are Al-Qaeda-related in it. Those are not groups we work with. They are the dominant rebel factions now, and I don't think we're going to be very persuasive with them to agree to any sort of peace arrangement with Assad. So it's hard to see that there is any peaceful end to this. I just can't. I'm having a difficult time understanding just who the Assad people would make peace with. Mm. And I think Borzu is very correct to say there is enormous concern about the Assad government just falling away.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That's Mark Seibel with McClatchy Newspapers. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. We also invite you to highlight the reporting that you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today they'll be talking about reaction to the president's NSA changes speech that we heard parts of this morning on Morning Edition. That's what's coming up on World Have Your Say in 30 minutes here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation about how we should talk about the growing divide created by the tech boom. We'll talk about the widening social and economic disparities in Northern California. What changes have you seen in your area? Here in San Francisco, we're seeing a massive rise in rents and also a rise in evictions. There's a lot of tension, but not much dialogue happening between just various sides of the situation. So what should a conversation sound like, and how should we create livable cities for all? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And we're going to talk about coverage of President Obama's NSA speech he gave this morning. And we'll also talk about the chemical spill in West Virginia that left 300,000 people without water. A lot of people have been told the water's fine, but after they're drinking it, they're going back to the hospital saying that they're still having major health problems. And we are joined today by Mark Seibel, chief of correspondence for McClatchy Newspapers. They publish 30 daily papers, including the Sacramento Bee and the Fresno Bee. And now I would like to welcome Russell Mokhyber to the show. Russell is editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, a weekly newsletter based in Washington. Russell actually lives in he's from West Virginia. Hi, Russell. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose.
So, Russell, before we talk about the chemical spill, I just wanted to briefly touch on President Obama's speech about the NSA. And we're just now getting some coverage of that, although a lot of outlets had the speech before he gave it this morning. He ordered intelligence agencies to get the court's permission before accessing records and directed agencies to stop spying on international leaders. Overall, what did you think of the speech? Any major news coming out of it?
You're asking me, Rose?
Yes.
Okay, so I actually didn't get a chance to hear the speech. I think from what I've read is that he's going to say that if the NSA is going to get this information, this bulk data collection, and it's going to use it, it's going to have to first go to one of these courts and get approval. So I think that's probably a step forward and vindicates Edward Snowden's work. So all the people in administration calling him a traitor are going to have to step back and go over President Obama's proposed reform.
And what did you think, Mark? What was newsworthy in the speech?
Well, there were several elements I thought were newsworthy. I would say that I think the overall newsworthiness of it is we now know that what Edward Snowden did was spark a conversation in this country about programs that, in fact, were seriously abused American expectations of privacy. Now, the president did two things, and then there's going to be a lot of discussion in Congress, and I suspect there'll be some pushback because what the president has done certainly contradicts, for example, what Senator Feinstein from California has always said, which is the NSA program was legal, it was well thought out and well executed. I think what the president basically was saying today is, well, it wasn't really, I mean, everybody performed in goodwill and we had a lot of things, but there were still some problems with it, and so we're going to undo it. And the first thing he really is tackling is this collection of cell phone metadata, which everyone has talked so much about. He's done two things of some significance today, and then he wants to do a third thing that's important. The first thing he did today was he limited how broad a search can be done of the cell phone data. Previously, if the NSA wanted to look at cell phone records, they were allowed to do what's called a three-hop search, meaning they could take a phone number and check all the phone numbers that had been called by it and the phone numbers that it had called and who those persons had called out to three hops. It meant that for every phone number searched, you potentially had millions of phone records reviewed. He's limited that to two hops. I think that maybe brings it down to about 10,000 phone records that would be reviewed for every number. But it is a limitation of a substantial degree. The second thing he did that's important is that he said those searches can no longer be done on the initiative of the NSA by itself, that there must be a court warrant issued every time they want to conduct that search. And that's an important aspect of the program because it had operated outside largely of court purview once the metadata was collected. The third element of this is the vague and not very well decided yet, is that Obama has, as his review panel suggested, has come down in favor of the NSA no longer being the repository of all this cell phone metadata. But they don't know where they want it to reside. Should the cell phone companies keep it? Should there be a third entity developed or created that would keep the information? But they wanted to get it out of government hands. And so that's he's set up an end of March deadline for the Attorney General Eric Holder to come up with a plan for where this cell phone metadata will reside. Now, it's an interesting discussion because what the president is saying is, well, this is an important part of our counterterrorism program. And he's holding to that line even though his own review panel and many other sources have basically said the metadata has never been significant to stopping or even prosecuting a terrorism case. So I think it's one of those political solutions rather than just say, well, actually, there isn't much reason to have this sort of a program. He's conceded that he's going to keep that. I think that's a stop to the intelligence community. But we're not going to keep it in the government any longer. So I think that's a very significant thing. The president also has come down in favor of appointing an advocate, a public advocate, before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is this secret entity that governs surveillance law. He's, you know, one of the problems with it, the only people who ever made a case before it were government attorneys. Now there's going to be, at least in significant cases, an advocate for the other side, whatever the other side might be, so that the judges get to hear a wider range of arguments for and against whatever action they're being asked to approve.
Well, and we'll talk more about this next week in more detail about President Obama's NSA speech. And then we just got an email from Gregory who says, this whole discussion is ridiculous. We have no idea what the NSA is doing or what other agencies are doing. So we'll talk more about this next week. But let's talk about what's happening in West Virginia, because this is a really important story. The BBC's Anthony Zerker doesn't think it's getting enough media attention. He points out that it didn't get any attention on the Sunday shows because they're so obsessed with Chris Christie. And so, Russell, you point out at Corporate Crime Reporter that the spill has drawn the attention of the national and international media. Last Thursday, state officials discovered a chemical leak from a 35,000-gallon storage tank operated by a company called Freedom Industries. The chemical had leaked from the tank. It's known as MCHM, overflowed a containment area and seeped into the Elk River. 300,000 people were without water. 200,000 are still on the do not drink order. And according to this piece in the BBC, as is often the case like this, the local paper, the Charleston Gazette, is providing some of the most insightful coverage. On Monday, their editors wrote, quote, "For years, most West Virginia politicians have painted U.S. regulators as evil, saying that federal pollution laws suppress business. Now, however, leaders suddenly see the feds as rescuers helping West Virginia cope with the Elk River chemical leak that halted safe drinking water for 300,000 people." So what are your thoughts on the media coverage and specifically focusing on how something like this could have happened?
Well, the Gazette has been the shining light in West Virginia. They have a couple of investigative reporters who go and confront officials and dig out the information. And so we're learning a lot from their reporting. But for the most part, the institutions in West Virginia are controlled by the chemical and coal industries, and there's they've been pushing a culture of deregulation, which has led to one disaster after another. In April 2010, you had the Upper Big Branch mine explosion that killed 29 miners. The Department of Labor did a report afterwards saying that the law violations at the facility, it was a Massey Energy facility, led directly to these deaths, and yet there was no criminal prosecution of the company itself. The company got a non-prosecution agreement. So this is one example of the kind of green light that the companies get from the government, both federal and state, in West Virginia. The interesting thing here is on this spill is that the plant itself had not been inspected in over 20 years. I have a friend who works at a waterwork facility down south, and he was telling me that they come up every year with something called a watershed assessment plan, and the drinking water utility actually identifies risks upstream. And the executives of this drinking water facility go and they visit with the chemical plants and the nuclear power plants upstream once or twice a year, and they do a walkthrough to try and determine what the level of risk is and how to control those risks. So that's how seriously they take the upstream risks. Clearly, that was not done here. There was no watershed assessment plan by this water company, which was a privately owned company. You know, like 80% of the public waterworks in the United States are publicly owned, but there is this push towards privatization. What my friend was telling me was he believes that drinking water utilities should be public exclusively, that the profit motive shouldn't be in there because it adds this extra factor where, perhaps they'll cut corners to make some extra profits. So that's one thing from the drinking water side. From the chemical company side, there was no significant regulatory oversight, and there is a culture of deregulation fostered by the corporations in West Virginia. And in West Virginia, there's no real difference between the Democrats and the Republicans when it comes to regulation. So, for example, in this congressional district, the second congressional district where Charleston is, the Democratic nominee for Congress, a guy named Nick Casey, is a former lobbyist for the Chamber of Commerce, and that's the Democrat. In the Republican primary, there's a whole bunch of corporate candidates, but pretty much there's going to be one corporate candidate against another corporate candidate in the second congressional district. That's indicative. There is a independent candidate, a former CBS News guy named Ed Rabel, who's raising the red flag about corporate control of West Virginia and the regulatory agencies. And so he's going to run an independent candidacy. He's already announced that for November. And there is going to be a slate of independents who are running for the lower house of the West Virginia legislature. It's called the House of Delegates. And they're going to challenge the two corporate parties in West Virginia. So there is some pushback. And I was listening to a radio talk show this morning, and people are very angry that even though, as you mentioned, Rose, a lot of people have, the do not use has been lifted for most of the people in the Charleston area. A lot of people are very concerned about it because they're still smelling this licorice smell when they turn on their taps, and rightfully so. They don't think that it's safe to drink. And the spokeswoman for the water company, I heard her on the show, and she was saying, they asked her, how can we drink this stuff when it smells so bad? And she said, just because it smells bad doesn't mean it's bad for you. Uh-huh. Now, the reality is there's articles coming out today from the Charleston Gazette and elsewhere that when they set this so-called safe level of one part per million, and my friend in the South who works for a drinking water utility said he would not drink this water at one part per million. Mm-hmm. When they made this determination of one part per million, they did it based on a study from Eastman Kodak, which was the manufacturer of this chemical. But It was for a different form of this chemical. It wasn't for this chemical crude MCHM. And in this chemical crude MCHM, there are other, it's not the pure form, it's another form that has other elements in it, and they didn't test for the other elements. So there's a big question now in Charleston about whether or not this is in fact safe. And after they said it was safe, a couple days later, based on, they're not telling us based on what, but they came out and they said that pregnant women should not drink this water.
Hmm.
And pediatricians in the area say kids should not drink this water. And just today, they reversed it for another area where they find, when they found higher levels of this chemical in the drinking water supply. So there's real fear and confusion and anger in Charleston about what's happened.
And it's interesting because we were just talking about, you know, doing a show about these chemicals and their safety. There's little known about this, as you said. And the New York Times quoted a scientist, Richard Dennison of the Environmental Defense Fund. He said the government calculation of a safe level appeared to be based on a single study by the chemicals manufacturer, never published, and that it included several leaps of reasoning that he called unfounded. So, Russell, are you hearing, are the citizens talking about these chemicals and demanding more answers?
Well, absolutely. I mean, what they're obviously concerned about is the health of their own health and the health of their families and friends.
And the groundwater, right?
And even though the word is out that, you know, they can drink this, there's a lot of resistance, and they're not. A lot of people, from what I've heard so far, just on people calling in talk radio in West Virginia, is people are not falling for this. They're not going, you know, by the government edict, go ahead and drink this water. They're just not doing it. And you know, a lot of the right-wing talk show hosts who are taking these calls, they're saying, look, I'm drinking this water, I'm showering this water. But the people who are calling in, they're resisting it. Because, number one, primarily because of the smell, but also because they're hearing that these tests were not done properly. And so they're not believing what they're hearing, and there's resistance. And, you know, the other thing is, if you're telling pregnant women not to drink it, and if pediatricians are telling children not to drink it, and if they're lifting, and if they're reimposing the ban on certain areas where they're finding higher levels, then you know, that just leads people to doubt even more government assurances that everything's okay.
That is Russell Mokhyber, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, a weekly newsletter based in Washington. And Russell is from West Virginia, where this chemical spill took place. 300,000 people were left without water. 200,000 are still on the do not drink list. The people who are drinking the water, though, are going to the hospital saying that they're still getting sick. We're also joined by Mark Seibel, chief of correspondence for McClatchy Newspapers, which includes the Sacramento Bee and the Fresno Bee. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on coverage of this? It is getting widespread coverage, but kind of shockingly, Mark, it didn't get any attention on the Sunday shows. Everybody's sort of obsessed with Chris Christie. But I was surprised that this didn't get much mention on the Sunday shows. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Mark, what are the bigger picture stories here that should be written? It seems like chemicals should be really written about, because this affects all of us. I mean, the EPA just yesterday issued a new rule that require companies to dump chemicals here in California, the frackers, to dump chemicals into the sea as long as they tell the government which chemicals they're dumping. So it seems like there some investigations need to happen on these chemicals.
Well, you know, when you talk about the Sunday shows being obsessed with Chris Christie, let's keep in mind that that's a good television topic, because it's really not a very complex issue. When you get into regulation, you get into a very funny political thing where it becomes much dicier for news organizations to make the argument in favor of regulation, because we live in an environment where everybody is opposed to regulation, where that's become a predominant theme. But I think what's happened in West Virginia, what happened in Texas with the West Texas fertilizer explosion, and what has been happening around the country for the last several years with explosions on rail cars carrying crude oil from the Bakken, which is, you know, where our big oil explosion has come. There's not much attention paid to that, and yet we see that regulation would have prevented each one of those. They're huge disasters on individual basis, and they could be even bigger if they happened in even more populated areas. And yet we're not having a real discussion of why aren't we doing a better job regulating. You talk about state officials versus federal officials. You know, the West Texas disaster basically devastated a town. It killed the first responders who showed up to put out the fire. It was an explosion every bit as big as the Oklahoma City the truck bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. And yet, no one has taken a regulatory look at the storage of fertilizer. On these rail cars, they've been talking for 20 years about how the predominant rail car used to transport liquids around the United States, called the DOT 111. For 20 years, they've known it was unsafe, that it didn't have thick enough sides, and there weren't some other bumpers and safeguards and whatnot on it. And yet, it can't. There is still no regulation. They're finally, maybe this year, going to finish the process of drawing up a regulation. But in the last 5 years, rail transport has become the primary way for moving crude oil around this country, from North Dakota to California and the refineries there, or to the East Coast. We've seen some terrible disasters in the last year, the biggest one being in Quebec, in which one of these cars derailed, 47 people died, and the downtown of Lac-Mécanic was burned to the ground.
Yeah, well,
those are huge disasters, and yet you can't seem to get people to regulate them. And it's not to stop the business practice. In fact, it's to protect the business practice.
Your reporter, Curtis Tate, has a piece up on the 10th of this month. California expects more crude oil by rail. It says the state budget plan Governor Jerry Brown unveiled this week bolsters the state office of oil spill prevention, increasing its budget by almost $7 million and adding 38 staff members to address the increased risk of inland oil spills.
Well, that's an important thing. You know, those rail cars move through Sacramento, through Fresno, through Modesto. You know, if they derail in a populated portion of those cities, you're looking at a real disaster. And yet, you know, we can't seem to get around the importance of regulating that, because the alternative is going to be some terrible disaster happens, and we just stop shipping rail by crude by rail altogether.
Russell, in our remaining minutes, going back to West Virginia, where is the story going at a time when 200,000 people still do not have access to clean water?
Well, on the law enforcement front, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District has announced a criminal investigation, and my prediction is that if there's criminal wrongdoing here, he will bring a case. Unlike the Massey case, where there were 29 dead bodies, and he chose to punt with a non-prosecution agreement. The reason is because the owners of this facility have been portrayed by the public officials in Charleston as renegades and outlaws. There's been some reporting that executives at that company have been convicted of crimes and so forth. So there's an interesting political economy of corporate crime prosecutions where you don't touch the major corporation, Massey Energy, but you go after the smaller company. So I think, you know, probably there will be a serious criminal investigation and probably action if there is criminal wrongdoing. We'll see that. There'll be ongoing state and federal inquiries. The Chemical Safety Board is there doing another of its investigation, after the last big explosion in Charleston, or big chemical leak in Charleston, they put forth a huge report that laid out what needed to be done in terms of regulation, and it just sat there and gathered dust and did not get done. But you sort of sense that this is a bigger deal, mm-hmm. because 300,000 people have been adversely affected, are going to continue to be adversely affected over the coming weeks. It doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon, even if they say drink the water, because people aren't listening. And there's also going to be political ramifications. Both parties are on the run on this. They pushed this deregulatory agenda, and now it's coming back to haunt them. And, you know, the question is, will the people be able to channel that anger and energy into political change to protect themselves and to protect the environment around it? That's still an open question.
And what are you working on right now, just quickly, Russell?
Well, actually, on this issue, on the West Virginia chemical leak issue, everybody is looking at what exactly happened. How did this happen? It looks like the company is trying to portray it as some kind of act of God. We had a real deep freeze here, and they're trying to point the finger at the deep freeze. I don't think anybody's buying it. So people are looking at that. And also, the other thing people are looking at is whether, in fact, one part per million is safe, and whether the government is going to come back and say, don't drink this water. It's not safe for you. And they're starting to say that, but they're only starting to say it for certain parts of the population.
Well, we will continue to follow this and possibly do a show about these chemicals. Russell Mokhiber is editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, a weekly newsletter based in D.C. He's from West Virginia. And Mark Seibel is chief of correspondence for McClatchy Papers, which includes the Sacramento Bee and the Fresno Bee. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How should we talk about the growing divide created by the tech boom? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the widening social and economic disparities in Northern California. Soaring home prices coupled with a rise in evictions has created tension between San Francisco's residents and its tech community. So how should we start a dialogue about these changes? What changes are you seeing in your area? And how should we create livable cities for all? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. Sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.